to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on Earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Hello, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today we have a pre-recorded interview with none other than Frank Thayer, who is also representing Scott Ramsey and Suzanne Ramsey regarding the Aztec New Mexico UFO crash and the recovery behind the whole thing. With that said, this will be a pre-recorded interview for March 8th, 2016 on BBS Radio, Station 2. So don't forget to check that out live from 3 to 4:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Now, many of you know that we have a world-renowned implant removal process series, which is part 1, 2, and 3. We have just added part 4, which is the Guardian Protection Initiation. It is pretty mind-blowing. I've had it done. It is amazing. Make sure you take the time to check that out. We are also working on a Phase 5 for those who are suffering other types of attacks regarding curses and spells and black magic. And believe it or not, that's a lot more common than people think. And so just stay tuned, because we really want to help everybody receive their own sovereignty, which is your divine right. Anyway, I was really intrigued by interviewing these guys. One of the reasons is Frank, my father, was a fighter pilot during this era. And he became absolutely obsessed with the whole UFO crash. He must have bought, seriously, tens upon tens upon tens, hundreds of books, literally, on UFO crashes. And because I grew up in an environment where that was just an accepted reality, knowing that there were extraterrestrials, he himself had had 3 encounters. I was very intrigued to talk to you today. And I thought this would be just so perfect. And, people being able to really see that there was something other than just Roswell, because everybody immediately thinks of Roswell when they think of, these types of crashes. Just for everyone to know, Frank Thayer is a PhD, and he came to the Aztec Incident Project in 2009 when Scott Ramsey shared witness information at the recovery area of the Hart Canyon location. Thayer is a New Mexico native with extensive journalistic education and experience. He's also a professor emeritus at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, and he has professional experience as a writer, an editor, a photographer, and an educator. My goodness, Frank, do you even have time to be alive? where he's also lived and taught for 11 years. He's a published book author and a co-author of the Ramsey's successful book that they've just released, which is called The Aztec Incident, Recovery at Hart Canyon. And this is what we're going to review today and hopefully get a little more insight into where Frank went with this whole experience. Now, for whoever is not aware, this incident took place in New Mexico on March 25th, 1948. And I'd kind of like to open it up with you, Frank, as to how did this all begin? I mean, I know you all literally went into significant depths of research. In fact, I saw that over 29 years was compiled to bring all this information forward. Over $500,000, folks, was spent to bring this information to light. And apparently they reviewed over 55,000 documents from government agencies. So I am just going to sit back and listen because this is a very interesting story. And it's such a huge cover-up. And it did not receive the press like Roswell did. And I think my first question is, why is that?
Boy, you started off very well. Somebody once described the Aztec incident as like a bag of pretzels. There's so much wound around to the cover-up and the suppression, and yet it all, once it's laid out, it makes perfect sense. Now, this is, remember that Roswell now seems to be part of the national consciousness, but when it happened in 1947, it was a one-day story. It disappeared, and nobody paid any attention to it until Stanton Friedman discovered Jesse Marcel in Louisiana and ended up with the Roswell Incident book, which I remember in 1980. Wow. But here we have, 8 months later, a flying saucer was seen in the early pre-dawn darkness by two policemen patrolling the northwest New Mexico sector. And they were following this thing. It was going by the highway, and it seemed to be wobbling. And they decided they were going to see if they could find out where it was going, because they'd seen UFOs before. So it wasn't anything new to them. And ahead of where they were driving, there was a rancher, 5:30 in the morning, coming out to feed his goats. And he saw this large glowing disc over his ranch and then headed straight north. And this thing struck a cliff across from his ranch. Sparks flew. And you'd think that it would have completely destructed, but no, it lifted up and kept going. And so here we have these cops following, and the next thing we know is some oil field workers in Aztec were told by their supervisor that they were afraid there was a fire out on Hart Canyon Mesa, which is about 11 miles from the little town of Aztec. They got out there. It was still, sun hadn't come up yet, and definitely there was smoldering brush on top of the mesa, but where the oil installation was at the bottom of the mesa, there was no danger. These two guys walk up on the mesa, and what do they see besides smoldering brush but a 100-foot diameter aluminum-colored disc sitting on the mesa, just sort of tilted over just a little bit, with the dome on the top and the dome on the bottom. And you figure the guys, 18, 19 years old, they don't have any sense of mortality. I remember that very well. And so one of them got up and walked around on this flying saucer.
Oh, my God.
And there he was looking at this dome on the top, and he saw circles that he said looked like mirrored sunglasses. Of course, in 1948, there were no mirrored sunglasses. Mm-hmm. This is in the interview he had with Scott Ramsey many years later.
Sure.
And he got close to this porthole, and there was a hole in it about the size of a quarter. He peered inside, and he saw two bodies slumped over what appeared to be a console. And that's how it started.
Amazing. Now,
we go from there to a long, thin pole. And we think that maybe it was the oil field workers who used this pole before the military arrived. And they shoved it through this hole because there's no other seam in the saucer, no bolts, no nuts, no rivets. It appeared to be a single piece. And they put this pole through the hole in the porthole. And they hit a button somewhere inside, and the thing opened up. The saucer opened up.
Wow.
Now, you and I have both seen The Day the Earth Stood Still, the movie.
Absolutely.
And remember how this thing opened up, and apparently that's what it looked like. It just opened up, and they were able to see two bodies, dead bodies, in the top of the saucer.
That's crazy. Now, I did read that there was speculation that there was up to 14 bodies. Is that what you think happened?
That's right. Now, as these two guys were joined by other oil field workers, by a couple of ranchers, the cops showed up. They had found their way to the mesa. There are two cops on the mesa, and a total of maybe 16 people, including a preacher whose story is very interesting. And they discovered there were 14 to 16 bodies. There's some variation on that, but total 14 to 16 little guys, 38 to 42 inches tall, all clad in a single piece coveralls or flight suits, whatever you want to call it. They were dark blue, metal buttons, but no marks of identification or rank. And this is how it stood until the military arrived. Why did the military arrive? Well, go back to the rancher at 5:30 in the morning. When he saw this, he went to a nearby store to find a telephone. Private phones were rare in New Mexico in 1948. And he made a long-distance call to Albuquerque, to Kirtland Air Force Base, and to tell them that he saw something very strange. They took his report and said, "Don't worry about it, we'll be in touch." We've heard that before. And so the military was aware, and maybe because of radar, they already knew that this craft was flying over northwestern New Mexico, because this is in the area where Los Alamos is. And Los Alamos was the home of the atomic bomb, as you well know.
Yes.
Okay. So by the time the sun was up in the morning, here comes a helicopter flying over the mesa. And Doug Nolan, the primary witness, said he didn't know what was more astounding to him, the disc sitting on the mesa or the helicopter, because he had never in his life seen a helicopter.
Wow.
And so there we go. And the military was on the way. And when they got there, of course, they stormed the mesa, divided everybody up into groups, and debriefed them, which is saying, "You didn't see anything here. You will not say anything about this for the rest of your life, because this is national security." And remember, there was a time when people trusted the government. And after World War II, I think people still did. If the government told you something, you could believe them. And we have come a long way since then.
Yeah, that's an understatement, isn't it, Frank? So now my first question is, they had never seen a helicopter. When was the helicopter actually developed and created?
It was after World War II, but it wasn't brought into service until 1948-49, and it became useful in Korea in 1950-53. And those people who saw MASH, the series, TV series, saw that they were bringing wounded in by helicopter. And, of course, by Vietnam, they became multi-use combat aircraft. But it was very rare to see a helicopter, and these two oil field workers had never seen one.
Wow, that's amazing. And you know, I noticed one of the quotes that really hit me in the book, it says, "The war had made New Mexico a training ground for all kinds of stuff like this back then."
Yes. Now, of course, I grew up in New Mexico, but there were probably more military in New Mexico than there were civilians. And you had Roswell Army Air Field, which became Walker Air Force Base in Roswell. You had Los Alamos National Laboratories, where they developed the atomic bomb. You had Kirtland Air Force Base. You had Sandia Laboratories. You had White Sands Proving Ground, 4,000 square miles through the center of New Mexico, where they were firing German B-2 rockets. And so you can see there was so much military stuff going on. It's no wonder that whoever these extraterrestrial visitors were, they were very interested in what was going on here, because the first atomic bomb was exploded right in the middle of New Mexico, right?
Yeah, supposedly.
And so we had all this activity, and of course the Roswell incident in 1947, where there's a crash and dead bodies, and now we have another one. We have in Aztec, in March 25th, 1948, you had a 100-foot disc, and 14 to 16 dead guys, and they were, and they weren't green, they weren't gray, they appeared to be cooked, they appeared to be charred, they were a brown color, and there's a lot of speculation as to how they were killed. Did the hole appear in, as they were coming into the atmosphere and decompression kill them? Was it radar? Radar, of course, being microwaves, and they were very strong radar at the time, and they may not have been prepared to defend themselves against that. It could be that at Los Alamos, that anti-aircraft fire punched a hole in their porthole and decompressed the cabin. This is all speculation, and we have absolutely no information about that. But we are sure that 14 to 16 alien bodies were recovered from that craft.
So now, do you have any idea where those bodies were taken and what happened to them?
As a matter of fact, we do. Mm. And the latest book, the Aztec UFO Incident, which was released in December, as a sequel to our first 2012 book and the Recovery in Heart Canyon book, that we got the book on the street. And we have learned in the months since then, we've been able to pin it down. We were pretty sure, but we now know that the Aztec saucer ended up at Wright Field, now Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, is the center for foreign technology investigation. And they would have had cryogenic facilities. They would have had the hangar space, the security to do this. And in our next book, which looks like we're going to have to do this again, we have found somebody who did see the Aztec saucer at Wright-Patterson in the 1950s.
Wow, that's and a huge breakthrough, huh, Frank?
It is, and it's only because this information is coming out, overcoming decades of the Aztec incident being called a hoax by the debunking community, whose main business is to debunk everything without ever researching it. Cushy job there.
Yeah, no kidding. And would you agree that this is even more of a brilliant cover-up by the military than even Roswell?
Well put. And I agree with that, because they blew it at Roswell. They put a story in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And they were able to cover it up very quickly, and so that everybody forgot about it. But still, when they came to Aztec, they had their act together. They were able to completely take care of it and make sure that no story appeared in any newspaper. Unfortunately, they didn't count on the people, the research scientists at Los Alamos, who were investigating this and spilled the beans to one of their pre-war friends. And these are scientists who worked with Vannevar Bush and during the war, very intense research to help us win the war.
Sure.
But they knew an oil man, Silas Newton. Silas Newton has become the most reviled character in the Aztec incident. Silas Newton was a millionaire. I mean, but he wasn't just a businessman. He was a geophysicist. He was college trained. He studied in Berlin, pre-war Berlin. And he knew these research scientists, and they told him the story about the saucer, because they thought that certainly the government's going to tell everybody about this within a few months. And this is how it got into a book, probably the most famous book of its era that nobody remembers, written by Frank Scully.
Yeah.
Frank Scully wrote Behind the Flying Saucers in September 1950. And he revealed the Aztec incident, and yet nobody remembers it. He sold 50,000 copies of the book. Nobody remembers it. And which shows how effective suppression can be and cover-up can be if people really, if the government really works on it. Sure. And we'll talk more about that as we go along.
Sure. You know, and Frank, you know, that's just like, that's probably one of the most classic, groundbreaking books ever. If people haven't had a chance to buy it, you really should have it as part of your collection if you're fascinated with, you know, flying saucers like I am. And, you know, I was going to ask you just to go back a little bit. You were mentioning that they're not quite sure how the actual saucer was downed. And I think what I read was that there really wasn't much damage to the saucer itself, but there was comments made about ducks being fried from the microwave radar waves. Can you comment
on
that?
Glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Okay. Remember, there was no distant early warning line in North Canada at that time, but the American government wanted to protect Los Alamos because and Roswell Army Airfield as well, because that was where the only atomic bomb squadron was located in the world. Mm. So there were three radar sites in northern New Mexico that were, and I've been to the ruins of one of them. It was an amazing establishment in its day. But the radar was so powerful. And remember, for your listener's sake, that radar really is just microwave beams. The same microwave that cooks your breakfast is what they were sending out to bounce off of targets to come back to the scope. And the people who worked there at Elvado Station would go out, and they found birds that were half-cooked from the power of the radar. And they found ducks, and they would take these ducks down to a restaurant a few miles from where the radar station was and have the cooks prepare them for meals. And that's before radar was fine-tuned and sophisticated. So there was some consideration that maybe this powerful radar penetrated the saucers and killed those who were in it. Mm-hmm. And back then, of course, no one could have said, well, then it couldn't have landed. But today we know that we have drones that can do controlled landings without anybody around. And back then, aliens who could go from interplanetary space probably had remote control abilities, had controlled landing facilities. So this saucer was able to set down gently, and there was absolutely no damage, no debris, nothing extra, just a tiny hole inside a porthole.
That is so interesting. And, you know, anybody who isn't well-versed on microwaving food, you know that when you microwave food, you kill anything that's alive. Your food
right.
is dead once you microwave it. It's one of the worst things you can do is eat dead food through a microwave. So I can't imagine that the microwave towers and the radar wouldn't have something to do with this.
Mm-hmm. And that's as good a theory as any. Others people say, well, maybe, like say, anti-aircraft fire penetrated the porthole and that's how they were killed. We don't know. We just know that there were dead aliens, and we are sure that the final destination in 1948 would have been Wright Field, which later became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Interesting. That's so interesting. Now, you mentioned that they were wearing the blue kind of flight suit unitards. Has there been any speculation on which star system they possibly came from?
No.
No.
There's okay. nothing. There was, I will say that, and I think Frank Scully revealed this in his book, that they found they described as a book, pages of parchment that had hieroglyphics on it that they still, as far as we know, have never translated. And you can't translate a code when you have no common ground between the species that issued it.
Right.
But they found various things. I think they found some sort of heavy water and tablets that they thought were food and a few things like that inside the saucer. So they seemed to be definitely organic creatures who were living in the saucer and flying through our skies. And that's as far as we've been able to get in determining what the government discovered. But Frank Scully said this. He said, the scientists who would tell their story for nothing in 1949 would not tell it for $20 million in 1950. The lid went down hard.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. Well, you know, especially when it's presenting a whole new concept of our reality, that we have extraterrestrials living outside this world, you know, which they didn't want and still don't want anyone to know about.
You understand this very well, but let's take a quick trip to a guy who was on the mesa, a preacher. A Baptist preacher had a church in Mancos, Colorado, just north of the New Mexico border there. But he had missionary work. He worked throughout the north, the Four Corners area, which, as your listeners know, is where we have four states meeting: Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah.
Right, the Four Corners.
And so he even taught Indians on the Navajo reservation, taught them English. But he was driving that morning, early morning, and he saw lots of dust going down this dirt road. And he thought, I wonder if there's been an accident and I can go, maybe I can help in some ways in comforting if there's some casualties. He went up on the mesa and he saw the saucer. He saw the bodies. Mm. And the military, of course, told him the same thing he told everybody else. You will not speak of this. It is your duty to keep silent. He went back to Colorado that night, and he called the deacon of his church to his house, and the deacon brought his son, Walt Sayers. And he said, I have to tell you about this. And he told them the story of what he saw on the mesa that day. And the son, Walt, was the one who told Scott Ramsey the story. And Walt said, I remember this story all my life because I never once, for the first time, I saw a grown man crying. And the Solon Brown, the Baptist preacher, said what he saw shook his very concept of existence. Mm. And that's how strong it was in 1948, when people still believed that human beings were the only conscious force in the universe. There was no life outside of Earth. And it's hard for us to imagine that today, but that's how people saw things back in the World War II era.
So this really rattled a lot of people's cages as far as their belief systems. I was even going to ask you that. I was wondering, you know, here's this small little town called Aztec, and they're faced with this where they actually see these bodies that are clearly are not human bodies. It must have been an amazing event.
Yes, and who are you going to tell? No one's going to believe you if you tell the story. These 16 people who were on the mesa, they were held their peace for most of their lives. And if it hadn't been for Scott Ramsey locating two separate witnesses, people who were on the mesa that morning and didn't really know each other, went their separate ways and didn't speak until they were their very much later years, when their health was bad and they had nothing to lose. And he interviewed both of them, and they told their stories, and the stories were identical, down to the number of people they saw on the mesa, the two policemen, the size of the disc, the bodies, all this matched. Now, if you trotted two witnesses into court without collusion, and they told two identical stories, you could even convict O.J., right?
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's just... It still amazes me today how Roswell got so much press and Aztec has virtually never really been heard about. Now, I wanted to ask you, they mentioned that there was a sonic boom. Were you able to confirm that?
Only one witness said that there was a sonic boom, and that was the rancher, Mr. Archuleta. And he recorded in his interview that he heard a sonic boom, which meant that the craft either was going very fast and then slowed down. Who knows? But he's the only one who reported that. He just, but they, all the witnesses in the early morning saw this disc wobbling as it flew, which meant that they thought that it was there may have been some problem with their navigation system. We only have that from those few sources.
Okay. Now, can you describe the actual flying saucer, the details of its physical description first?
Let's see if I can do that. 99.9 feet in diameter by measurement.
Wow.
And it was very thin, very flat. And Doug Nolan said that the rim, which was just a few inches thick, the very rim, had gold bands running around the circumference. The dome stuck up something like 3 to 4 feet above the surface of the disk. And, of course, it was sort of wedge-shaped. It was thicker in the center than it was at the edges. And there were portholes all the way around this dome. But it was smooth. There were no aerials. Again, there was no rivets, no seams. It appeared to be cast in one piece. And until they punched those buttons inside the cabin, it didn't look like there was any way in or out. And then it opened up, and they were able to see what was inside.
That's amazing. Now, were there any artifacts removed from the actual saucer, Frank?
Well, Frank Scully says yes, and the Air Force apparently thinks there were, too. I think that there was a mention of a small cube. Just a piece of metal, the size, they said the size of a king-sized pack of cigarettes at that time, and that it gave out a tone every 15 minutes after the hour, and they didn't know what it was, whether it was a radio or a sensing device, and again, they said there was water, there was these food tablets of some kind, and when they got it to Los Alamos, apparently they did try to disassemble it to some degree, what was inside. And I would say, knowing how people are, that there were artifacts that were spirited off the site by the scientists and supposedly got around. And one fellow, and we'll have to get into the University of Denver shortly, but a guy named George Kohler, who was an advertising executive for a radio station in Denver, Colorado, he bragged to some of his people that he'd seen that he had artifacts of some kind. And I don't think he ever did. Mm. But he paid a heavy price for that, with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations came down on him like a ton of bricks.
Oh, I bet.
And I did an interrogation of him. And in the book, we have the exact question-answer session that Kohler was smart enough to record. Now, when these guys were finished with him, they said, "We know you're recording this. Give us a tape." And he told his engineer, "Prepare the tape for the gentleman." And they went away with a blank tape. And we still have today, we still have that audio interview. It was done on a wire recorder. And most people today would not remember wire recordings, but before we had tape recordings, before we had digital recording, there was a cabinet with a spools of wire that ran swiftly through the heads, and the audio quality is amazing. We have Doug Nolan's interview. We have Silas Newton's speech to the University of Denver, which I know we're going to get into, and we have George Kohler's interview with the Air Force of Office of Special Investigations, which I don't know, I've never heard of another interview with them that's ever been successfully recorded.
I know. I thought that was fantastic. And I just want to remind everybody, the book is called The Aztec UFO Incident. It's by Scott Ramsey, Suzanne Ramsey, and Frank Thayer. And it also has a preface by Stanton Friedman, which is awesome. So please do yourself a favor, because this has so much meat in it as far as the way in which you investigated it. I mean, you really looked at all angles. I was super impressed with the book. Now, Frank, question on, the fact of the craft goes down. I think I remember reading that there was some sort of concrete platform underneath, and that this was a big question mark as to how did this fit in? What did this have to do with the craft actually landing there? Do you have any perspectives on that?
Thanks to Scott Ramsey's curiosity. And this guy, he's a bulldog researcher. He never lets anything go. And because, you know, what we really wanted to write was the best flying saucer book ever written that could not be challenged by the debunkers. So when he discovered the site, and he's worked on it, like I say, for about 30 years, that he found that here's a small mesa, and the road from Aztec goes right around it and then heads north up into Colorado. But somebody cut a road from the basic road up on top of the mesa, which is, let's see, maybe 50 yards. Who would bother making a road up 50 yards up on to the top of a mesa? And along this road, there is a concrete block about 3 foot long, maybe a couple of feet wide, and I forget how deep it is because it's buried in the ground. And there's no reason for that concrete block to be there unless you needed a footer or a footing for a crane. Now, because of the silt on the mesa, if you put the brace for the crane in the dirt, it would not hold. When you lifted something heavy, the crane would tip over.
Sure.
So the speculation is that that concrete block was the support for this heavy equipment when they actually lifted the parts of the saucer and put it on trucks.
That's amazing. Now, and you guys do an awesome job of determining how it is, it's thought that they actually moved this massive saucer, you know, 100 feet wide. Was it something like, did you actually walk the location of the crash, Frank, yourself?
Yeah, I've been on the mesa. Walked around. You know, it's funny. You get up there, there's scrub juniper and things on the top of the mesa, but there's a flat spot big enough to hold a 100-foot saucer very nicely. And it's kind of chilling to stand there and say, I know this is exactly where this thing landed. It couldn't have been any other place. It couldn't have been any other incident. And you can look around and you can see for miles and miles and miles, and you can imagine this thing coming up from the south and settling down on the mesa. But Scott and Suzanne Ramsey spent a lot of money saying, okay, we have to prove that you can get the saucer off the mesa. Go back to Frank Scully. Frank Scully revealed that the military discovered that the saucer was modular. It didn't seem to have any construction points, but you get inside and it was held together by pins, heavy pins. They removed these and they were able to divide the saucer into three segments. Each of these segments was, 30 feet in width. And they loaded them onto what we call the Dragon Wagon. The Dragon Wagon was a combat vehicle meant to haul damaged tanks off the battlefield in World War II. Mm. Perfect for this kind of work.
Yeah.
So you put the saucer, and the book has a chapter and shows diagrams of how this thing would have been fitted onto the Dragon Wagon and tied down. And you go down the back roads, and you can get from the Aztec Mesa there down to a place where you can get to Los Alamos with very few people, if any, ever being the wiser.
That's amazing.
And that's what they did.
That's amazing. Now, where do you at this point through the investigation think that it ended up?
Well, we think that it went to Los Alamos. We're sure it went to Los Alamos first because that's the kind of information that the research scientists provided. But then, and we don't know how they shipped it there, but it went to Dayton, Ohio, which is a long way by road, no interstates back then. But I know from my travels in the Southwest, I was at one time a cadet at Texas A&M University, and we're driving down the highway before there was an I-10, and I saw a convoy, and there was a long trailer covered with canvas, and it was probably an ICBM, mm-hmm. but there was no way to tell. And so the government hauled stuff like this all the time, and nobody pays any attention to it because you can't see what it is. And we see that in Kecksburg. They hauled that away. And the Roswell craft, I'm sure that they had bigger pieces that they had to take by truck to, again, Wright Field. No Area 51 at that time. Area 51 was still an atomic bombing range in Groom Lake, and it was only later that Area 51 was developed, and it's possible that some of this material ended up there. With 14 to 16 bodies, you can spread them around to research facilities all over the nation.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, if you think back to that time frame and the fact that we were just coming out of World War II, rebuilding the United States, as well as getting prepared and being pulled back into Korea, security, national security was at an absolute high magnified point, wouldn't you say? I mean, that must have really added to the whole drama of you know, clamping this down and not allowing these 16 witnesses to ever, you know, comment on it. I know that they were threatened, right?
I gather from the witnesses that they used patriotism as the key. In Roswell, the threats were naked. They were death threats. It was frightening what they did in Roswell. But I think they were a little more subtle on the Aztec Mesa. But we have to remember where we were at that point. We won World War II, but the Soviets were suddenly a terrible adversary, and we felt that our entire way of life was threatened by communism. And so I think that anything that they could do to protect technology, to get us, to get an advantage over the Soviets, they would do, and they do whatever they could to protect it.
Yeah.
So I think that's where we stand there.
Well, now that brings up a good point, because here we are post-World War II, and we've now all of a sudden started the Operation Paperclip. Can you go a little bit into that? Because that plays such an important role as to why this was very mysterious and very, you know, just very bizarre.
Yes. Thank you very much for mentioning it. Operation Paperclip was top secret at the time, but I know that at least 2,000 former Nazis, scientists, engineers, policemen, military people were brought over from Germany at the end of the war, because we had no way of combating the Soviet Union. We didn't anticipate them to be our adversary, but yet they were devoted to communizing the world. So the Germans were the only ones who really knew what they were about. And we picked, even war criminals came over here to work on our projects. And so we had many of the people who were experts in aeroforms and propulsion. And let's mention here, there was no visible means of propulsion in this saucer. No jets, no propellers, no rockets. It was a solid piece of metal, and yet it flew and went from planet to planet. We had no idea what that was, and I suspect that we've made progress, but I don't think that we've mastered it yet, the idea of magnetic field propulsion. And there's a lot of research that should be done on that, but the Germans had also done some research in this area. So some of them went to Wright Field, some of them went to Los Alamos, some of them went to White Sands Proving Ground, and right here in Las Cruces, where I live, there was an entire colony of German scientists, Nazis, who were brought over. And they lived cheek to jowl with people in Las Cruces, and people didn't even know they were here. You can keep a secret if you want to.
It's like the greatest secret never told at that time, in my opinion, because, you know, there's so much evidence that Hitler was obsessed with this and was light years ahead of a lot of the other nations on the planet.
You said it. You're right.
You know, in investigating the saucers and propulsion and that kind of thing. And I just think it just goes to show you how there's just this massive network cover up on a very high elite level within the world leaders. You know, just the fact that here we are in World War II, fighting the Nazi regime, and yet here's Operation Paperclip going on, where hundreds of them, if not thousands, are brought in through Mexico to do this types of investigation, research, etc. It's mind-blowing.
Yes, and it makes perfect sense. And people say, well, you couldn't keep this a secret, but yet look at the stealth fighter, the F-117A, developed at the Skunk Works and out in your direction. Mm-hmm. And hundreds of people worked on this craft, and nobody ever said a word. No secret ever got out until this thing was seen over Iraq in operation when we began to attack Iraq. And this shows that secrets can be kept and will be kept by the government. If you're working for the government and you're worried about your pension, if you're in the military, you are never going to reveal anything because you can lose your entire livelihood overnight.
And your family.
Yeah, yes.
You know, I mean, they don't screw around. They're going to take out your wife, your children, your parents, whatever, in order to make it clear that you don't cross that line of not keeping those secrets.
I'm afraid it's true. And this is just the exercise of power. And I also remind your listeners that probably our elected representatives, our presidents, they don't necessarily know anything about this. This is kept from them by the power elite, who are, some people call it the shadow government. And we don't investigate this at all. We are concentrating on proving to everybody that the Aztec saucer was real. It came from outer space. There's no other explanation. And there were aliens aboard.
Mm. Yeah.
And you take it from there.
That's a good point too, Frank, because, you know, it's suggested that there's even 33 levels of security clearance above the president. You know, so, I mean, we look at the president and it's all been deliberately designed that way.
Yes.
You know, now, before I forget, I thought this was fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about the cleanup crew? I thought that was just fascinating. You know, how they go about removing this sort of crash, because apparently there, I think your book goes into a lot more detail about how there were apparently four of these total around that time frame.
Mm-hmm. Good. I think that, and it doesn't matter whether it was an airplane crash or a UFO crash, that they are going to make sure that when they leave the area, it appears nothing ever happened. They bury everything that they're not carrying away with them. They, in the Aztec case, they replanted trees. And there's an aerial photo on our 2012 book that shows the mesa, and there, you see the photo, and there's some trees that are planted in a straight line. Nature doesn't plant trees in a straight line. And so they definitely have done this. And we point out in the book how, say, well, certainly the personnel records would show these people were working on the Aztec recovery. No. These records were kept at Walker Air Force Base, formerly where the Roswell Army Airfield, and the people working in personnel were tasked, anybody who was assigned to do this cleanup were post, well, they're on temporary duty in Florida, they're in the hospital, they wrench their elbow playing tennis, and so on, so that they, if they go back and say, well, I was there recovering a flying saucer, no, we have your personnel record. You never went anywhere near that. You were in Roswell the whole time, or you were on vacation in Bermuda. And every aspect was controlled. And I'm sure they've gotten better at it today.
It is amazing. I think another thing, you guys did an outstanding job just in showing the massive disinformation campaign, how they actually cunningly used specific people to create this into a hoax. And I'd really like to get into that. But before we delve into that, I'm curious, how did Frank Scully successfully get his book published?
He was under the radar.
He
didn't know the science. At first, he didn't know the scientists. Silas Newton, the oil man, met him and befriended him, and introduced him to a couple of these scientists. And Frank Scully called them Dr. G, G-E-E, 8 to 9 scientists that he knew about that he would never reveal by name, who had revealed the saucer story to him and to Silas Newton. And so the government was not aware that this secret was out. This happened between 1948 and 1950. And they had not, I don't think they had expected these government scientists to leak this information to their friend, the oil man. And when it got out, they had to work double time to do what they did. And I think that when we get into this, you'll begin to understand how effective they were in destroying the story for decades.
Oh, big time. Now, and before we dive into that, talk to us a little bit about Project Blue Book, because I feel that that's what's kind of hanging over the whole saga of not hearing about the Aztec crash.
Well, we go back and we begin in 1947. We had the Roswell incident. And then the same year, the government instituted Project Sign, supposedly to collect flying saucer data. And then we have Aztec in 48. And then in 1949, the government closes Project Sign and opens Project Grudge to replace it. And their whole job there through the 1950s and 1960s is to debunk the whole idea. They had a Robertson panel in 1953. Remember the flying saucers overflew the American Capitol in 1952, summer.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So they had a panel, and the panel was designed to explain to the public, there's nothing here, keep moving, folks, nothing going on here. And in the 1960s, they had the Condon Committee. In 1962, of course, they created Project Blue Book to the official government investigation, well, I mean 1952, sorry about that, and it replaced Project Grudge, and supposedly the open investigation of flying saucers, it was nothing of the kind. It was a PR device. They had a couple of people, and you sent your sighting in, they filed them, and they explained them away, and you were done. And finally, we had the Condon Committee in the 1960s. In 1968, the Condon Committee, oh boy, this was an academic exercise by respected academics. Professor Condon was a panel paid by the government to investigate the UFO phenomenon. And he said at the beginning, said, I know what the conclusion is going to be, but I'm not supposed to reach it until for another year. And the conclusion was, there's no evidence there was ever anything to the UFO phenomenon. Now, one of his committee members was a Professor Roy Craig, who lived in north of the New Mexico border. Professor Roy Craig was signed on to the Condon Committee report, but he visited the Aztec crash site more than a dozen times.
Wow.
And why would he do this? Obviously, he knew better than what the Condon Committee had to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Blue Book was then, in 1969, terminated. December 1969, they decided there was never any evidence that there was such a thing as a flying saucer ever seen. None of the reports were believable.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's laughable, you know. And
yes.
And the fact that they created, you know, Grudge and Sign and Blue Book, and really what it was also designed to do was just to collect all the data and keep it repressed, you know, in addition to the disinformation program out to the public.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we have the Professor Donald Menzel of Harvard was one of the members. Supposedly, he was also a member of the MJ-12.
Mm.
And yet, his outward product, he wrote books on flying saucers to show there was no such thing. He's the one who created things like swamp gas, temperature inversion, weather balloons, and all these things that showed how stupid people were when they saw flying saucers.
Oh my God.
And that has been so permeated the public that nobody wants to report when they see a UFO. They know what they've seen, but they dare not report it because the media and other forces will laugh at them and call them crackpots.
It's so crazy. I mean, I had to laugh when I saw that one of the disinformation campaigns was about cotton balls.
Oh, yeah. I love that one. Can I go on that just for a minute?
Yeah, please do. I thought it was hilarious.
March 1950, 2 years after the Aztec incident, the town of Farmington was overflown by swarms of flying saucers. These were aluminum craft darting through the air. They're all aluminum except one. One was glowing red. And some people said it was a tribute to their fallen comrades 2 years ago. But hundreds of people in the town of Farmington, which is about 11 miles from Aztec, they were there, and they saw it. It was a front-page story in the Farmington Daily Times, but it never made it anywhere else.
Wow.
Because they interviewed a state policeman. His name is Andy Andrews. And he told the press, what the people are seeing is fluff from cottonwood trees, which is something that happens in the spring. And that's the quote that was carried nationwide. Now, Andy Andrews, you know what? Andy Andrews was on the Mesa in March 1948. He was one of the ones who saw the Aztec saucer. Now, I wonder why he debunked this one.
Wow.
I'll leave it for you to speculate.
Yes, of course. Well, you're getting too close to the truth here, you know?
Yes.
Way too close. Well, let's talk about how does the government and this shadow government, as we call it, how do they go about preventing this type of information from being acceptable, intelligent, realistic? Where do we go from here? What ended up happening once these 16 witnesses were stifled? Was there anybody at that time who wanted to come forth and say, you know, to hell with this, I'm going to make sure I get this information out?
No. Before I get there and unwind the pretzel, so to speak, we have found, and this is, we haven't proved this, but we have found anecdotal evidence that everybody who was on the Mesa that morning prospered in life.
Mm.
Now, remember Matt Brazel in Roswell? He's the guy who found the debris field down there.
Yes.
He was a poor as dirt rancher's helper. And 2 weeks after he reported it and he was hauled in for his debriefing, he had a brand new pickup truck. He had enough money to buy a frozen food locker in Tularosa. And he never said another word about Roswell from that day forward.
Wow.
So what about these other people who became, if not wealthy, very well-to-do later on? I can see somebody prospering, but oil field roughnecks becoming wealthy? Seems unlikely to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let your listeners think about that when we go back, and let's see how the government was able to completely stifle the Aztec saucer. We are in March of 1950, about the time of the Farmington mass flyover. Scientist X is scheduled to give a lecture at the University of Denver, Colorado, to a Science 101 class. Scientist X chickens out because his government employers have said, you're not going to talk about this. But he'd already told the story to Silas Newton, the oil man.
Mm.
Silas Newton becomes Scientist X. He walks out on the stage, and we have the tape. We have every word he spoke to that class.
Wow.
And it's a wonderful interview, and you're really there when you listen to it. And he tells these people, wall to wall, standing room only, in the lecture theater in the University of Denver, there is such a thing as a flying saucer. And he tells them about Aztec. Not 500 miles from here is where this saucer landed. And he, at the end of the lecture, he was caused so much hubbub that his George Kohler, the radio station guy we've mentioned who did the interview with Air Force Special Investigators, hustled him off the stage and got him out of Dodge,
wow,
hiding him. And within an hour, the government officials were there at the University of Denver saying, we want to know who that guy was. Scientist X didn't have a name at that time. And it wasn't until Scully's book came out that people had it tied, put one and one together to come up with this. So The University of Denver forms the beginning of Scully's book and the lecture that was given there. Okay?
Wow.
So, in March 1950 to September 1950, September, Frank Scully's book is issued. And it's out of the bag. You'd think that everybody in America would now understand that there is a flying saucer and it's been recovered. Well, what they had to do is make Frank Scully appear to be a dupe or a fool. And there's always a spoiler in every event. Our spoiler is a fellow named J.P. Kahn, C-A-H-N, a rich guy, born rich, never had to work a day in his life. He was freelancing for the San Francisco Chronicle. And he went to Frank Scully when he heard about this incident. He said, I want to buy your story. I'll pay you $25,000 for your story. And I want to break it to the nation through the San Francisco Chronicle. Frank Scully said, no, I'm going to write my own book. And that did not sit well with J.P. Kahn, who was used to getting his own way. And so he decided then he was going to go to Silas Newton. Silas Newton was loyal to Scully. And so J.P. Kahn decided, I'm going to get you. He started a vendetta. He went to the FBI to try and get dirt on Silas Newton. He told Frank Scully, if you will report that you were duped, I will support you. And Scully said, no, the story is the story. And granted, he didn't write it as a scientific story. He wrote it as in breezy journalistic style. But we have found that everything he put into his book is verifiable. Frank Scully was no fool. He was a professional. Now, J.P. Kahn is wandering around California, Arizona, Colorado, trying to get dirt on Silas Newton. He finally finds a businessman in Denver who thought he got a bad deal from Silas Newton, selling him a worthless oil detection device and so on. Filed charges in the District Court of Denver. In 1953, Silas Newton and his partner, Leo Gebauer, were hauled into court and accused of fraud. And they were unable to mount a successful defense. They were not allowed to bring their own devices in. They got an Army surplus device. This is like the one that Silas Newton sold to Herman Flater, the guy who filed charges. Found guilty. You know what? He was never sentenced. He was never fined. He was told to pay court costs. Silas Newton paid the court costs, and it was done. But the damage was, and the reason the FBI cooperated, because this way, if Silas Newton was a crook, therefore, Aztec was a hoax. Can you follow that logic?
No. No, and the fact that he didn't get charged and he didn't end up doing any jail time, it almost feels to me like a stage performance.
Yes, and they staged it very well. They arrested Silas Newton, threw him into the back of a police car, put him in jail, hauled him across from California to Colorado, and treated him like a common criminal. But he took it all in good stead, and when the trial was done, he was found guilty. He and his friends went out to dinner that night, and he was his usual jocular self. He didn't realize that the goal was not the criminal charge, but the goal was to completely destroy his credibility and Frank Scully's.
Wow.
And it worked, because it wasn't until the 1980s that somebody came up and said, I want to take another look at this. And of course, Scott Ramsey was taking another look at it, having discovered it, never having known about Frank Scully's book when he did.
Incredible. I have to read this one, if you don't mind. I just think it's so excellent, this one paragraph. And it's actually in Frank Scully's writing, his own handwriting, his own writing, I should say. It says, this vicious circle had now gone to criminal, if not psychopathic, lengths. When one understands that Kahn's driving motive was to make a fast fortune and thus get out of the wage slave class overnight, it's easier to understand his reversal once his Caesarian ambitions were thwarted. He abused my home and hospitality. He sought to destroy a circle of friends who had known and trusted each other for years. He threw scandal around like confetti. He cooked up libels by the dozen. He proved himself a louse in the blouse of journalism, a dangerous man in America, though possibility not without value if shipped abroad and handed the role of agent provocateur to some unfriendly foreign power. Oh, my God. It's like a perfect example of how the government works.
Yes, and Scully nailed it right there. And but I have to say this about Kahn. He was an excellent writer. He wrote an article in True the Men's Magazine in 1952, September, Flying Saucers and the Mysterious Little Men, an extremely long article that had nothing to do with flying saucers, nothing to do with little men. All it was an indictment of Silas Newton, Frank Scully, Leo Gebauer, just to say that they were hoaxers, they were con men, and that nothing ever happened. And this article, there's still people in the flying saucer field today who say it was a hoax. That's all it ever was. But they never did any investigation. And thank goodness people like William Steinman and Scott Ramsey and then the rest of us looked at the evidence for what it was. And it is one of the best proved cases of a saucer recovery that we've got.
I bet. And, you know, I was going to ask you, have you determined who had hired Kahn? Because I don't feel, you know, Kahn, in my opinion, just by reading your book, it's very obvious to me he was sent in to do this very deed, which is to discredit Scully and to bring down this whole suggestion that this really happened.
We don't have any idea who his consorts were, but we do know that he was extremely angry when Scully wouldn't sell him the story. This is going to make his future to write about a flying saucer recovery in the San Francisco Chronicle. And when he didn't get it, he was determined that he was going to bring down the entire house. And he went directly to the FBI to try and get information about Silas Newton, who was, of course, being a wealthy man, had a file. And they found that Silas Newton was a patriot, even if he did vote Republican. But then I think that he probably had a lot of conversations with government people who encouraged him to go after and perhaps funded his vendetta as he went through the Southwest digging up dirt, trying to find ways to get to Scully through Silas Newton and his partner Leo Gebauer. And so ending up with the charges being filed against Newton and Gebauer in the Denver court. J.P. Kahn was at the trial in November 1953. Why would he be there? He had nothing to do with the trial. Yes, he did. It was his instigation and his energy that brought this about. I don't know how much the government was involved. I don't know how much of it was a vicious feeling of revenge that was part of his character. One can never know. We tried to cover it as best we could from what information we could get. Unfortunately, J.P. Kahn died before Scott Ramsey was able to find him. He died a few months before he was located.
You know, Frank, it just that feels like such a huge missing piece, because it's really apparent to me this is a man who actually got Hoover involved through the FBI and really delved into this whole, you know, disinformation campaign and slandering Silas and Scully to such a vengeance and to such an expertise, the way in which they did it and the manner in which they did it. It's got government all over it.
They were just cold. But they could do that to anybody, because you and I both know that every human being has events in their life that, when held out to public scrutiny, make them appear to be less competent than they really are. Mm-hmm. And that was the job of J.P. Kahn, through this magazine article and through the charges that were filed, to show that Frank Scully didn't know what he was doing, that he was He'd been duped. He'd written a story that never happened, that Silas Newton was an evil con man who was just trying to enhance his oil interests, and that Leo Gebauer was the proprietor of an electronic shop who manufactured doodle bugs, which are those oil detection devices, and some of them didn't work, but apparently the one that Silas Newton had did work. And then J.B. Kahn was saying, what this really is they're trying to say that the doodle bug was created by aliens, and they never said that. The scientist that Silas Newton knew worked on geomagnetism, and it was technology that was emerging, and today is just common practice for finding things under the ground.
Yeah, but I think the other thing that was important about it was it could find metallic objects under the ground really easily, right?
Mm-hmm. But Silas Newton said that you can use these devices to find oil, water, metals, gold, silver. And today, of course, you can buy one in the corner store. You get a metal detector that will detect just about any type of substance.
Was this relatively new, this device? I mean, how long had it been around?
I don't know. I think that the research had started before World War II, before these scientists had gone into government service, and continued after World War II. But their work became classified during World War II. Well, a lot of these people became very famous industrialists. They helped form Texas Instruments, which was one of the early electronic monsters that really created calculators and things that we use today. But I think that if you look at it, you say that the secret couldn't be kept. And so Silas Newton knew about this, and he probably had oil detection devices that he worked with the scientists to perfect. But this is a sidebar, that they were able to make it seem as though Silas Newton was just a con man, and the black boxes he was using didn't do anything but bilk people out of their money.
Right. And the other thing that doesn't wash with me is that Kahn was already wealthy. He had no issues with money.
Yes.
He already had prestige as a journalist. And so why go after this particular story with a vengeance when he had the ability already, that door was already open for him to be able to take that into any other arena, in my opinion, just by reading his background. And the other thing I was going to ask you was, now didn't Silas present him some artifacts? Didn't he show Kahn some artifacts? I think that was like the beginning of the end for Silas.
And that was, and of course, that was in the article that he wrote in True Magazine, J.P. Kahn, that supposedly Silas Newton had artifacts from the Aztec saucer, and J.P. Kahn stole some from him. But they turned out to be plain old aluminum and were frauds. I personally do not think, I don't know if Silas Newton actually had artifacts or not, but I do not think he would have allowed J.P. Kahn to steal anything from him. But it shows the character of J.P. Kahn if he is willing to pilfer something from somebody whose confidence he was trying to secure. And this shows a lack of character.
Sure.
I don't think there were any alien artifacts that J.P. Kahn ever handled.
Well, that's interesting. So basically, that was a lie too.
Yes.
Okay, so it's just all part of building this story upon another story upon. How long did this whole smearing campaign go on?
Well, it started around the time Scully's book came out, and went until through 1953.
Oh my God.
And in 1952 is when Kahn published his long article. But before that, we have, and again, we located in the University of Wyoming archives, which has all of Scully's papers and recordings. That's where we got these recordings of the Denver lecture, of the interview with George Kohler, and so forth. And what they have in the archives was a typescript written by, I think it's an autobiography. I don't think Scully wrote this. It was Silas Newton's autobiography, not complete, but maybe 200 or 300 pages worth. and I've read, I still have a copy of it. And he talks about his life. He talks about his marriages. He talks about his golfing. He talks about his oil field experiences. He talks about flying saucers. And in this autobiography, he is 100% saying, I believe this. This really happened. I'd stake my reputation on it. And he did. He staked his reputation on it. And he never wavered from that. And neither did Frank Scully. They knew the story. And Silas Newton told Scully, we have done much good. And they, to the very end, they believed that they told the American people the truth.
Jeez, that's crazy. Well, so what ended up happening? Can you share a little bit about what happened the day of the actual court case, you know, in court?
The trial lasted several days, and you had Silas Newton and Leo Gebauer as defendants. You had a fellow named Herman Flater, who was the one accusing them of bilking him of $35,000 or whatever it was. And you had the district attorney in Denver who was prosecuting the case. And they brought witnesses, Herman Flater. They would not allow Silas Newton to bring his witnesses in, and they would not allow him to bring his device in for inspection by the jury. And it was very much an engineered court appearance. We've covered it fairly well, but there, I think even online you can find the transcript of the trial. Mm. And anybody who reads that's going to say, these guys were railroaded. Wow. It was predetermined. They had to find Newton and Gebauer guilty of fraud. But after that happened, they never did sentence them to any prison time. They never did sentence them to pay a fine. It was all swept under the rug. And along with it was the Aztec saucer.
Oh, my God. Now, what happened to Newton and Gebauer? I mean, what were their lives like after this massive smearer?
They went back, and Silas Newton, after this, was still the same man he always was. And he went from... then, and we tracked him to the final place he worked. And this, strangely enough, in my home area in Grant County, New Mexico, Silver City. And he had an office in 1971 in Silver City, New Mexico. And he had a conflict with somebody over a mining claim. And somebody wanted to charge him with fraud over this mining claim. But the person who bought the claim from him said, I don't want to prosecute. I want the claim. And so he had the same thing. But it was then that he was in his 80s at that point, and he died. He had a hydroponics farm down near Deming, New Mexico, which is about 55 miles south of Silver City. It's right on I-10. And so he was experimenting with all manner of things. He was a born entrepreneur. He made a tremendous fortune during the Depression. And can you imagine 1935 having $25 million?
I can't.
That would be an amazing fortune in today's dollars.
Absolutely.
And so he was not a dumb man. I'm sure that he did some sharp deals in the oil business. You have to. But when you read his autobiography, he had a big heart. He married a woman who was a sports writer in New York, and she got cancer, and she had a year to live. He told her, you have never learned to spend money. He gave her $1 million and said, I want you to spend every penny of this. And she did before she died, in the year that she died. She spent every penny of that $1 million. I think that shows what kind of a heart he had.
Yeah. How cool is that? You know?
Yes.
That's awesome. Well, and again, just so if people are not familiar with this, the book by Scully is Behind the Flying Saucers, because we are making reference to it an awful lot, and it's really worth having in your library. Now, getting back to the actual crash itself, were there any other broken parts or pieces that were found or anything else that you guys were able to get your hands on as far as pictures or documentation, anything like that?
No. Again, there was no damage to this craft. It was taken apart and moved intact to Los Alamos. Now, some people have investigated the Mesa, and William Steinman, who did a foreword for the book, he was the first one to write a book after Scully, and he released it in 1986, UFO Crash at Aztec, A Well-Kept Secret. And I didn't discover his book until 2006. That's how well-kept the secret was, that he never sold more than a dozen copies of the book at that time. Oh. Now his book has become very sought after by flying saucer researchers. And he read Frank Scully's book, just as you and I have, and he got in a car and drove all the way from California to Aztec to check it out. And he discovered that Frank Scully was right on all accounts, and Frank Scully had never been to Aztec. So Frank Scully's story was verified by him. And that his book came out in 1986. Scott Ramsey hadn't seen it. And Scott Ramsey had gone out to New Mexico as part of his day job, selling magnetic wire for winding generators and that kind of thing. And he heard two guys talking about, oh, where are you going this weekend? Oh, we're going to go out deer hunting. Where are you going to go? We're going to go out to Hart Canyon by the old crash site. And he said, what, crash site? And he pumped them for information, and they said, oh, yeah, it's supposed to have been a spaceship that landed out there. You know what stories are like. And he found out where it was. He went out there. And as with Steinman, they found some curious things on the Mesa. Steinman found some things lying around and buried, old Army sea ration cans and foil wrappers and clips for the M1 Garand rifle. That used to hold eight rounds of 30-06 ammunition, and some things like that that suggested a military presence had been on the Mesa. And in 1986, there was a fence on the top of the Mesa. It's now broken down because it's become such a popular place for local people to go. And so those are the kind of artifacts that remain. You mentioned photos. In the book, there's a great story about photos for sale, a sting operation that happened in Denver, the Edelweiss Cafe. Somebody supposedly named Klein went to the Edelweiss Cafe to try to buy photos of the Aztec crash in 1950. And he was going to buy these photos from a fellow named McLaughlin. And the reason we know this is because these are U.S. Army documents depicting the attempted purchase of these documents. Now, this guy Klein didn't exist. So he was obviously an agent of some kind trying to buy photos. Now, if there was no Aztec crash, why would the government want to pay $1,500 for a set of black and white photos? In 1950, you could buy a brand new Buick for $1,500. Mm-hmm. So that's something to ponder on. It's a very interesting story to read in the book.
It's amazing. It just keeps going and going. Back to William Steinman, which, you know, of course, his reputation precedes him. He apparently had quite a bit of, let's just put it this way, disadvantageous experiences after he came out with his book, right?
Ah, what a euphemism. Yes. He was working in the aerospace industry, and his bosses told him, don't publish a book on flying saucers. He published the book with a fellow named Wendell Stevens, who since died, but he lost his job. He got death threats, his midnight phone calls, things like that, and he had to leave. He was living in Arizona at that point. And he had to leave Arizona and go into seclusion and decided that he never wanted to be a part of the UFO research from that day on. He has since warmed to it again. Scott Ramsey has made contact with him, and he's become a lot more open about it again. And I think he realizes that his work was not in vain, that what he discovered really had added to research, because William Steinman located a fellow, a scientist named Sarbacher, who had found out from Wilbert Smith in Canada that the flying saucer was a higher secret than the H-bomb in 1950. Wow. That's, which is pretty good secrecy level for something that doesn't exist.
Amazing. Yeah, I was just about to ask you about Sarbacher, because apparently he really gives a lot of credence to Scully's material as well as,
yes,
as Steinman's. And can you talk a little bit about he and his background?
William Sarbacher was definitely a research scientist, and he was a highly respected professor as well. And he did geomagnetic research in his own. But he met this fellow, Wilbert Smith, who worked for the government of Canada, and Smith was very open and said, yes, this really happened. And Sarbacher wrote a letter to William Steinman where he said outright that the facts in Scully are substantially correct, period.
Interesting.
And this is an astounding thing, and Steinman made the mistake of sharing it with a couple of UFO colleagues who promised confidentiality. It's like telling your best friend, don't ever tell anybody but. And you know that by the end of the day, it's going to be all over Facebook.
Yeah.
So I think that that Steinman was very disappointed that his friend didn't protect his confidentiality until he published it in his book. But the letter from Sarbacher is one of the most important foundations for the Aztec incident going forward. And that happened in 1986.
Well, and he also brings forward naming the scientists. Now get the names. John von Neumann, Vannevar Bush, Robert mm-hmm. Oppenheimer. Oh, my God.
Well, Oppenheimer was at Los Alamos at the time. We have not been able to link him to the flying saucer thing. But Vannevar Bush was in charge of U.S. research during World War II. He was the man in charge of all these scientists. And, of course, Scott Ramsey has been to archives all over the country running down the biographies of the scientists that we believe were the 8 to 9 scientists that Scully named as Dr. G. And we have short bios of every one of these people, and we're pretty sure that they are the ones that talked to Scully, and a couple of them are primary candidates for revealing the information to him along with Silas Newton. And Silas Newton probably knew all 8 to 9 of them.
That's just crazy. I mean, this is such a cover-up. It's just so obvious. I also wanted to just read this small clip from Sarbacher's letter, supposedly you guys quoted, and it says, there were reports that instruments or people operating these machines were also a very lightweight, sufficient to withstand the tremendous deceleration and acceleration associated with their machinery. I remember in talking with some of the people at the office that I got the impression these aliens were constructed like certain insects we've observed on Earth.
Yes, isn't that interesting?
Very.
That the idea that these may have been manufactured organic beings rather than what we normally think of as humans, and we don't know how close that was, but certainly the things that we've read about from Leonard Stringfield and other researchers that are not really verified because he could never reveal his sources, but that they were, some species were apparently very different from humanity. Others were very similar to people. And I think the discussion of the Aztec people was their heads were slightly larger than ours. They were smaller in stature. They had very small noses, if any. Not much in the way of pinna for the ears, and slits for mouths. And Scully says that the teeth of the aliens at Aztec were perfect, and they seem very similar to those described from Roswell. But we know from Paul Hellyer, the Canadian defense minister, that he says outright, and he's not a lightweight himself, he says there have been upward of 50 species of aliens identified. And it shows just how much is hiding under the surface of the cover-up.
You know, Frank, in all of my interviews, I can't remember who it was I interviewed, but they were saying that, you know, for every type of species on this planet, there are going to be races. And we're, you know, we already know there's so much documentation about the mantids, which are of like a praying mantis looking species. You know, you have the ant people. People have had direct affiliation with them. You have the bees, believe it or not. There are people that have had, you know, experiences with them. So it does not surprise me that these could be of some sort of, you know, insectoid slash humanoid type race. You never know.
No, and that's all speculation. We can, if we use our reasoning, we say, why not?
Right.
I mean, it doesn't necessarily... Evolution does not have to necessarily have to produce the kind of organic creatures that we are,
correct,
much as we like ourselves. But that there can be, I like the idea that there are reptilian creatures out there as well, because reptiles are very, very good candidates for survival. I mean, they survived the dinosaur era and they're still around. So, but that's something we don't get into very much. We're content to prove that there was an actual object from space landed and recovered and bodies recovered, and there's no way you're going to talk us down from that.
Yes, you guys have done an awesome job. Now, just can you talk to us a little bit about the mysterious scientists that were involved in working on these crafts and you know, analyzing these beings that were removed from the craft? Because you do a really thorough expose on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have, and again, we tried to keep the key scientist bios as short as possible. We have Cecil Green, Patrick Hegarty, Eric Johnson, Carl Hyland, Karcher, Schmidt, Peacock, Dick McDermott, John Tate. I think that Dr. Hyland, Carl August Hyland, could have been the Scientist X originally scheduled to make the lecture at University of Denver. And I say that because he had an office in Denver at that time. And he's the one who could have gotten cold feet and said, I can't talk about this anymore. He may have scheduled it months ahead of time in late 1949 and decided that the government had convinced him that it's in his better interest never to speak of this again. And that's why Silas Newton went on stage instead of him in March 1950. So, but all these scientists had expertise in electronics, in geophysics, in areas of magnetism. And magnetism keeps coming back as an important element. Silas Newton was convinced that this saucer was propelled by magnetic waves and that were generated from gravity. And you and I both know, we've just heard about the gravitational waves they've now recorded in outer space around these two black holes.
Yes.
And but I think that this, somebody once said that once we solve gravity, once we understand gravity, all the secrets of the universe will be open to us. And I kind of agree with that. Albert Einstein, in his unified field theory, said that gravity and electricity and magnetism were all bound up together. And these things create mass, and they create time. We feel imprisoned by time, but it's only a dimension that we will eventually find ourselves outside of. But I digress. I'm getting out of my field.
No, I like it. Keep going. I agree with you.
And I really think that as organic beings, we are sort of compressed into a time-space continuum, and we appear to age and we appear to die, and yet most of us realize that death is only a transition, that there is no such thing as an ending of existence. And once people realize that, life becomes a completely different entity for us. And I think that this is, if these craft are traveling using gravity, or negation of gravity, if we could but master that, there would be no more need for electric power stations, be no more need for rockets boosting satellites into orbit, and it would be a complete revolution in the way life is lived on Earth. And maybe there are governments who feel we're not ready for that.
Yeah, well, we know that the governments, quote, feel we're not ready for that, unquote. But with the statistics showing, I mean, good God, what are we up to now? Something like 70 to 80% of the public now believes that, you know, flying saucers and whatever you want to refer to them as, UFOs, do exist. I mean, I think this is an old storyline that, quote unquote, we're not capable of hearing the truth. And I just think it's a bunch of garbage.
But it still is part of doctrine. And
yes,
I would say this, Alexandra, and that is, once doctrine is established, it's very difficult to dislodge it. And if in 1948 people look back at Orson Welles and the War of the Worlds broadcast and said, this is how the public will react to any revelations, they are never going to change. And that's just the way it's going to be. I would say that we can't expect any change. And I've said this openly. I don't believe that the government, whatever we want to call the government, will ever reveal what it knows about UFOs. It never will. No matter how much proof is out there, how many seminars there are, how many symposia, they never will. And established universities will not, by and large, investigate UFOs. Mm-hmm. It's just not done. Astronomers will never admit there is such a thing. It's death to your profession if you say you kind of accept they could be real.
It's, you know what, that's a really good point, Frank, because the other thing, we talk about this a lot within the community, and the fact of the matter is we are in the midst of disclosure, but it's a softer, it's a more subtle disclosure. That's number one. Number two, I don't think that the disclosure that we are hoping for is ever going to happen, which is exactly what you're referring to, from the standpoint that the majority of the people that have participated in that big secret, okay, that they claim that none of us have the capacity to handle, they are all incapable of crawling out of the hole that they were absolute, total, complete liars. Because once you... once you dig deeply enough and you find out what they have been privy to, there's really no sugarcoating that the fact is they've held this from all of us. It is our sovereign right to be able to know what is in our world and beyond, period. And, you know, you're right. They're never going to come out if they can. Cover, you know, it's a CYA thing. They will not only lose their careers, but they're going to be, geez, in my opinion, it could be a massive witch hunt by the public masses when these things start really coming out in, you know, exponential amounts of data, which is already starting to happen.
Mm-hmm. You put it very well. And we start in 1950, 33% of the public said they believed flying saucers were real. Today, a conservative estimate, 55%, accept that some UFOs are extraterrestrial spacecraft. The more education you have, the more likely you are to accept the reality. But one of the courses I've taught for many years is propaganda and public opinion.
Interesting.
And once you understand propaganda, you realize that the public, the mass public, wants the government to be their daddy.
Mm-hmm.
The government will tell you what's real and what's not real. And the Associated Press, and again, journalism, which I teach, they will not cover UFOs. It's just not done. It's considered to be fringe science, and therefore only crackpots believe in UFOs.
That's crazy.
And they're not going to change their policy. That started in 1947 with the way the government treated the press after Roswell. And it hasn't changed in 60 years.
That's just crazy. And that's really interesting that you got into propaganda, because, you know, that really is the government, in my opinion. And it is time for the human race to take off their diapers and step into their training wheels, really. I mean, we are at a place in time where we need to grow up and open our eyes and recognize who are here to support us and literally create that which we want, which is, you know, a more peaceful, just this, when I read your book, the one thing that it really solidified for me is even those such as Silas, okay, even though he seems like an upstanding guy who had all this information and, you know, really tried to bring it to light and that sort of thing, I still have to step back and even be suspicious of the role that he played, from the simple standpoint that he was a millionaire, if not a multimillionaire. And he'd never even saw jail time. And, you know, walked away from the whole thing kind of like, okay, you know, we're done. That was a great stage performance for the public. You know, there's almost like a feeling of being paid off to keep all the distraction going on around this court case, you know, so that in the meantime, the government and the black government, I should say, the shadow government, is analyzing these bodies, trying to figure out what star system they're from, trying to figure out what they eat and why they're here and what is it that they want to bring to the world to really open us, open our eyes and bring our awareness higher.
Yeah, I don't know how, can you imagine someone like Silas Newton or even Frank Scully not realizing the firestorm that this would create.
Correct.
To them, they had just found something very interesting and they wanted the public to know about it. But I think that we cannot imagine the relationship of Earth to the other members in the cosmos. I'm a part-time herpetologist. I love snakes. Neat. And I go out on the highway at night in the summertime, driving along, and I see something in the highway. I stop with the blinding headlights, get out with my camera, pick up the snake, take a picture of it, make some notes, put it down, and go on. Now, what does a snake know about what just happened? He says, what just happened to me?
Exactly.
And the same thing with flying saucers coming down, bright lights, people experience things, and then they go away. Maybe abductions or whatever. I know you talk about that at times, and with implants and so on.
Right.
And we have no idea what these external experimenters or observers are doing and why they're doing it, because we are not yet at the point where we want to even discuss it with them.
Exactly.
But I think the government may already have made some arrangements with them, but we don't deal with that at all. We're content to just prove one incident and get it out of the hoax category and make sure that it's an established event that no one can ever refute.
No, and you guys have done an excellent job. And, you know, before we tie things up, I just want to ask you if there's anything else that you feel we haven't touched upon as far as, you know, what you felt was the most blatant piece of evidence or information that shows beyond a shadow of a doubt that this did occur.
I think it was the two witnesses separately interviewed, identical stories, so identical that they could not have made this up. I think that you've covered it so well.
Thank you. I think
that we just need to mention that the Aztec UFO incident is available at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble. It's you can also get a signed copy by going to theaztecincident.com, all one word, theaztecincident.com, and you can find some reference to it also at my You can write to me through my website, frankthayer.net. But the book is available, and I think it's a good read. We spent a lot of time on it. It's not just good research. I think it's also a good story.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's really well done. And I do want to just remind everyone, you know, these folks are not made of money. They've done a lot of their – used a lot of their own personal capital. I spoke with Suzanne just the other day. And if you can support them just in the way of purchasing this book, it would be greatly appreciated. And again, it's called The Aztec UFO Incident. You can find it on Amazon, and you can also reach Frank at frankthayer.net. So, Frank, is there anything else you want to say before we tie this up?
No, we're hoping to go ahead. We've got some more information. We're hoping that we are going to, in the next year or two, come up with a third book that will tell us more about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and what happened to the saucer after it was recovered.
Oh, that'll be fascinating. Then we get into some really good juicy pieces of information, huh?
I hope so.
Okay, well, thank you, Frank, for coming on today. I really appreciate it. And we also want to thank again Suzanne and Scott Ramsey for their participation in this amazing feat, which was to go through, 55,000 plus documents just alone to bring this information forth. I mean, this is really, truly one of the greatest secrets never told about a flying saucer that's been downed here in our United States of America.
And so, we've got more of those documents will come out too, I'm sure.
Yeah,
it's been a blast here. And Scott, Suzanne, and I really thank you for bringing us on the show. And we wish you well and hope to be back. See you soon.
Well, thank you. Let me know when your next book is available, and we'll definitely cover it. I'm always fascinated about this kind of stuff. I can't help myself. I was the daughter of a fighter pilot, so he talked about this kind of stuff.
I'd like to read that story, that's for sure.
So anyway, I just want everyone to know that I love you, and I thank you for listening. And stay tuned. We've got some more juicy interviews coming up. Again, you can access all of our services and products, including the Violet Ray Alchemy, on galacticconnection.com. And do not forget, we do provide you the newsletter. It's 365 days a year, folks. We do this gratis. It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of time. And we give this to you as our gift so that we can raise the awareness and also bridge the gap of the spiritual community with the ufology community and the conspiracy community. I think we're doing a pretty good job, and we need all of you to continue to support us. So anyway, lots of love. We thank you so much. Stay tuned.